This workshop offers you penetrating insights into a psychologist's thoughts on passive-aggressive behavior. The material was recorded at a professional conference to an audience of therapists, but the information is practical for frustrated, suffering partners as well.
When we think about a passive-aggressive person, we are only talking about those people out there, right? Does not apply to... Because we don't do those kinds of things. It's on a continuum. There's not a human alive who doesn't do passive-aggressive stuff. Is there anyone in here who has ever agreed to do something for your partner that at the time you made the agreement you really didn't want to do it, but you couldn't think of a really good reason to say no, so you just said okay, and maybe you hope you get to it or they'll forget about it? We all do this stuff, so it's not like it's us and it's them. It's on a continuum. The only difference is that a real hardcore passive-aggressive tends to orient their life around this. And that's the only difference. It's on a continuum of how severe it is, how often it happens, and the number of places where it shows up in your life. All right, so what is it about a passive-aggressive person that makes them, we don't exactly look forward to having them show up? What are the characteristics of a passive-aggressive person? They tend to do or be what? They don't come on time. It's another way of saying they will not follow through with agreements. They what?
Uninvolved.
Big headline, uninvolved. Now, if we break that down, uninvolved in what?
Uninvolved in being present.
They don't follow through.
Uninvolved,
what'd you say? Last week, they don't listen. Well, last week, Ellen was saying something to me, and I didn't hear what she said, and she said it again, and Molly, who's our 17-year-old daughter, she said, "Mommy, Daddy just went to that special place he goes to when he doesn't listen." And I was listening to, Daniel Amen this morning talk about ADD, and so I'm no stranger to ADD. But I really like the way Molly said it. "Daddy just went to that special place." And so, yeah, they don't listen. They don't get involved. What else with passive aggressives that makes them so difficult when they do it so often? A lot of nonverbal communication. And the nonverbal communication tends to be on the negative end of the continuum instead of the beaming, enthusiastic type of nonverbal. Anything else that makes them really hard? They deny what they do either is upsetting or they believe that it should not be upsetting what they do. Then you're really stuck.
From a therapist's point of view, there's no
therapy in the progress. Yes! You can work with a hardcore passive aggressive for this long and feel like you've got this much progress. And it's frustrating. It's really, really frustrating. They find faults. They nitpick. Sometimes there's kind of an irritable moodiness about them. And they are oppositional to plans, to goal setting, to being involved. And if you're married with roles, goals, and responsibilities, there's either opposition or they tend to just whatever you want. And they don't say anything up front, so they give the impression that they are supportive or going along with it. And a lot of times they just don't have the normal, the reaction to a situation is, they don't have kind of a normal emotional response to it. They look kind of flat. And if you ask them what's going on, they will say not much or nothing. But is there anything good? Think about this. There has to be something good about passivity. Is there anything that's good about just being passive? There's got to be something good about it. That there has to be something good about it. If you're passive, is there anything that's good? You what?
You don't have to think,
and you don't have to what? You don't. Oh yeah, theoretically you can avoid arguments if you're passive. And if you're passive long enough, sometimes stuff just blows over just by life, you know, just like, well, you didn't make a big deal about it. Okay, that's good, because it didn't need to be, have to be a big deal anyway. So sometimes it really can pay off if you're passive. It does have an advantage that if you just underreact, some things aren't worth attending to. But when they do become passive, think, I want you to think about this. There are different elements of passivity. There's a discounting involved in passivity. Am I getting too much of an echo here? That what? Let's turn this one off. Will you turn that one off? And maybe that would help. There's a switch. Maybe that would help if I... Hey. Whoa, was that a lucky shot? Whew. Ah, lucky. Okay. Got really lucky. So listen. Passivity. Passivity has different elements. There is a series of discounting. When you're passive, passive-aggressive, you go through a whole layer of discounts. Number one is you discount that there's a problem, and somebody already mentioned that earlier. You say there's no problem. Look, what I do, dear, around discipline with the kids, what I do around spending money, it's no big deal. Get over it. So they just discount or deny that the issue is even a problem, and they just cut it off at the pass. That's number one. So you're working with a couple. Passive-aggressive person says it's not that big of a deal, and the partner is really, really overwrought. So number two, the passive-aggressive person will discount the significance of a problem. So you go from discounting the problem to, all right, it's a problem, but it's really not that big of a deal. What is the big deal? Yeah, it's a problem, but it's not that big of a deal. The mess that I make, the clutter I have around the house, no big deal. I have the occasional drink, no big deal. So they just discount the significance of it. Then they discount the solvability of it. So you're going to run up against this all the time. They discount the problem, the significance of the problem, or they say that they will discount the solvability, which means I can't do anything about it. Nothing can be done about it. And this is especially true that you hear in bureaucracies. Anytime you go to a bureaucracy, passive-aggressives love working in bureaucracies because there's nothing I can do about it. So they discount the solvability. They discount themselves. They say, well, I can't do anything about it. I can't do this. I can't do that. It's beyond me. I don't have the knowledge. I don't have the skills. I don't have the talents. I can't do anything about it. So they discount themselves and don't believe that they can acquire the knowledge, the motivation, or the skills to do anything about it. And then they discount their thinking. The way they discount their thinking is what will show up in therapy, and we'll talk about this in a little bit. They discount their thinking, which means that they go into confusion. And we'll get a little bit more into that. They just go into confusion. They discount what they feel, which mainly means that they just deny what they have, that they feel anything. They just don't have an emotional reaction. Now, that's at one level. Now, they do discounting at the behavioral level, too, which means that at one extreme of passivity, you have somebody who's catatonic, and they just become catatonic. That's extreme passivity. Somebody else has to come in. Somebody else has to take over. Somebody else has to function for them. That's the extreme of passivity. Somebody else has to function for you because you're not involved in solving the problem or taking action. So that's at one extreme. Then you have an overadaptation on the other side, which is whatever you want, dear. Whatever you want. And they just go along with it. Now, the problem with just going along, I mean, wouldn't that be great? Wouldn't you want to be married to somebody who never gave you a load of stuff, and whatever you said you wanted, they would just say, okay. And they say, where do you want to go to dinner? Fine with me. Where do you want to go on vacation? Works for me. How many kids do you want? Works for me. Doesn't make any difference. Wouldn't that be the best thing in the world to have somebody who just said, works for me? Is there a problem with that? What could be a problem with that? The passive aggression builds up resentment. Any other problem? That's exactly right. Any other problem with over-adaptation? It's like playing tennis without a partner. That's right. There's no pushback. There's no pushback. There's no way for you to stretch or grow yourself. So there's no pushback. So the over-adaptive person also at some point will say, and if you bring all this up early in the interview, that it may, like even in the first interview, you could say, all right, so you go along. It looks like there's a part of you, and I hope you all take away this. When you work with couples or an individual, it makes confrontation so much easier if you frame it as there is a part of you that does this, and probably another part that has a different idea. So you can say, so a part of you goes along with whatever your spouse wants. That makes you a good guy. You avoid a lot of fights, da-da-da-da-da. And there's probably another part of you that on occasion might have a pretty strong desire yourself. What happens then? Almost always they will say, well, when I finally make a request, because I don't make requests very often, then my partner really owes it to me to follow through. And so there is this expectation. You now have to deliver, dear partner, because I ask for so little. But when I do, it's big, so pay attention and give it to me. And when it doesn't happen, boom, now we got a big fight. And the passive-aggressive says, hey, how do I win? I don't ask for a whole lot. When I hold my cup out for my meager request now and then, how come you don't respond? Because they never had that deal up front to begin with. Incapacitation is a form of passivity. Being drunk is a form of passivity because now somebody else has to take over for you. Somebody else has to solve the problem. And in a sense, you might think about like this. Violence is a form of passivity because you are not constructively involved in solving a problem. You're being violent. When violence is not called for, somebody else has to come in and intervene. When it goes on, it becomes the CPS or whatever. But violence is a form of passivity because you discount your thinking, you discount your ability to solve problems, you discount your ability to be constructively engaged. You get violent as a way of solving the problem. Somebody else has to come in. So, how do they show up in life? If you ask a passive-aggressive person about what they want in therapy, what kind of responses do you get? I don't know is classic. Classic. What else do you get? If you do get... Go ahead. I just want her to be happy. And then when they say that, do you have a typical response? I just want her to be happy.
Oh, great.
This is great. Now we go back to the confusion again. So you say to the person, well, do you know what it takes to help create happiness in your partner? And then they respond with, I have no idea. Well, of course, the next step is logical, isn't it? All we got to do is get that person to be clear on what makes their partner happy. Therapy is finished, right? So they say, I do everything they want, they should be happy, which is that over-adaptive response again. So they should be happy. I don't know why they're not happy. I do everything they want. Or, I just want them to be happy. Instead of, you could say something like this, oh, and I thought this therapy was going to be so hard. Thank you. It really, really is good. Man, all you want is to make her happy. Oh. Jeez, it's usually hard work with couples, you know. But now that we've got clarified what it takes, thank you. Instead of struggling with them, don't struggle with them. You will lose. When they state a goal, almost always, and this is so crucial, when you finally get them to try to state a goal, it almost always will be a goal stated in the negative. And this is your first clue if you get to the goal-oriented place, that what you're dealing with. They will say things like, I don't want to what? Say what? I don't want what? I don't want to fight anymore. I don't want what? I don't want to be unhappy. I don't want to be depressed. I don't want to be miserable. I don't want to be nagged. I just want to be left alone. I just want my partner to get off my back. If you think about goals right here, this is neutral. These are goals stated in the negative. I don't want. I don't want. I don't want to be unhappy. I don't want to be depressed. I don't want to smoke anymore. I don't want to be nagged. I don't want. I don't want. I don't want. This is neutral. This is what I do want on this side of neutral. Passive-aggressive people, if they like their work, outside of work, they will have very, very few goals in their life that are on this side of neutral. Now, this is what's interesting. If you work with somebody around a goal that's stated in a negative, and I will tell these people this, I will say the best you can hope for, if we just stay with the goal you have, that you don't want to be nagged, you don't want to be unhappy, you don't want to be depressed, if we just stay with that and get up to neutral, the very, very best we can hope for is that you will reach indifference or apathy. That's the best outcome we can hope for, because there is nothing positive to pull you forward. And under stress, I guarantee it, when your goals are stated in the negative, under stress, you will always regress back to your earlier stage of coping. Always under sufficient stress, because you have no vision of what's going to pull you forward. That's what we're faced with in our work in here. So I just keep educating along the way. When I find a person who's passive-aggressive, all the way along the line, so that they get the idea of where we're going, which is going to make it more collaborative. Because without a collaboration with a passive-aggressive person, you will be frustrated from the second minute they walk into the room. I love it. When one guy said, saying what I don't want feels more powerful than saying what I do want. Saying what I don't want feels more powerful than saying what I do want. And he said, I said, what do you mean? He said, well, it's like broccoli. If someone tries to force broccoli on me, I can say I don't want it. And I feel strong by saying I don't want broccoli. And maybe they will offer me something else instead. That's how he basically approached the world. He said, if I tell my wife what I want, she can say she doesn't want it, then I'm screwed. The experience of going through the rejection of my wants and saying what I want hits her. She doesn't like it. That's so painful. I feel inadequate. Because there's nothing strong pulling him forward, he gives up, flops back to this side again, and that's pain over there. So he doesn't say what he wants. A different guy said, I proposed to my wife because I really didn't want to get married, which is the attraction on this side. He said, I was afraid of losing her. So what I did was propose because I was afraid of losing her, and I didn't want to get married. That side of neutral. If you push to say what they do want, often you will get vague things like, I want freedom, I want happiness, I just want to feel good. And those are basically fairly meaningless goals. If you think about happiness, the definition I like of happiness is, it's the progressive realization of worthwhile goals. It's not the achievement of goals, it's the progressive realization along the way of worthwhile goals. And when you say you don't want, it's hard to get a progressive realization.
Is passive-aggressive
what I hope will you say what you just said, because that is the core of what the passive-aggressive person is about, and it is the core of why you struggle with them if you use more traditional ways of working with other people and try to apply them to passive-aggressive people. Say it again really loud, because you nail the core of it.
I was wondering
if passive-aggressive, as you described it, could be used with
somebody who's developed
a really
guarded lifestyle
based on not expecting too much and
having
a guarded lifestyle. Yeah. Is a passive-aggressive similar to somebody who has a very guarded lifestyle because they've had so many losses in their life that the expectation of reaching toward a goal and not and failing and being disappointed is so painful, they wall themselves up and say, I will not go there again. Which means I will stop hoping, I will stop setting goals. So when you come in and you say, what do you want out of being here? I guarantee a passive-aggressive person will do everything they can to avoid setting a goal because you're moving them closer and closer toward pain. The way it works, if you go back to the keynote this morning, whenever significant pain that you have in your life gets stored in one part of your brain, that pain gets stored in the limbic system. The limbic system is good at reading patterns. It doesn't talk in words or subtleties. It doesn't send you a fax. It sees patterns. When you start to approach something that looks like, sounds like, or feels like a pain you've experienced before, it will send you an alert by it makes you feel bad in your body. You feel tense, you feel anxious, you feel nervous. You don't want to go there. You don't want to talk about it. You don't want to experience it. It's your limbic system in operation attempting to protect you from feeling future pain if you reach for something and you're disappointed. It's stored there, and so you have to have other ways of starting to work around this. Inside, and your limbic system does not respond to instructions from the prefrontal cortex. It's like a phobia. If you have a phobia of going across a bridge or elevators, you can tell yourself all day long that it's safe. And it does. The limbic system has its fear stored there, and it will not respond to instructions. So you can have all the insight, and it still doesn't respond. So you have to have other ways of dealing with this, which is what we're going to talk about when we get into interventions. Someone else had their hand up. The connection with EMDR begins to disconnect or create. In talking with all kinds of people in the medical field, from surgeons to neurologists to people who have PhD in medical research, they talk about a path. Like, you store a memory here, and if you're going to retrieve a memory, you just like follow this path. And this is what you do to retrieve the memory, then you feel bad. EMDR and other energy psychology things seem to create a different circuit back here. So either you land at a slightly different place or you might override that old response, which then frees you up to make other choices. And EMDR is really good with that. There are some other things, too, that are good with that as well. But that's what happens. So you really do need to change some of the brain circuitry to get through this. The main goal for the passive-aggressive person when they come into therapy is not change, not improvement. All they want is relief. Their goal is relief. That's huge when you start to figure out, what am I going to do with this person or this couple? Nobody at this point, when they first come in, you, the spouse, the passive-aggressive person, you have three different agendas. Nobody's on the same page for what's going to happen or what you hope will happen in the office. The spouse wants you, the therapist, to do what? Change the partner so that they show up and do all the things the passive-aggressive doesn't want to do. The passive-aggressive person wants what? Relief. Just get my partner off my back. You, the therapist, have a goal for each person to do things like what? Change, improve, get insight of what you're doing, and start moving along so we can be happy and I can feel good that I'm a therapist. That's why I was a therapist. So everybody changes, they're happy, I'm happy, and we sing Kumbaya, and oh man, I'm glad that I'm a therapist. We have three different agendas when they come in. Somebody is going to make a sale. Somebody is selling somebody all the time in that room, and the best salesperson will win. The most skilled, persistent salesperson will win. A passive-aggressive can finally convince and sell their spouse and you that it's hopeless, doesn't do any good. They will make the sale. I have convinced my spouse and you that nothing will happen significantly, at least in this office. So they've made the sale. In marriage, So we'll talk a little bit about marriage and a little bit, how does a passive-aggressive get to be this way, and then how do you intervene? What do you do with the passive-aggressive person? What do you do with their spouse? And equally important, I think, what do you do with yourself when you're in the room with these people? How do you deal with yourself, which is, I think, probably number one. But we'll just, these are the other chunks we're going to talk about. So in marriage, they show up like we've talked about before. They are resistant to reasonable requests for adequate social roles, goals, and responsibilities around the house. They are resistant to reasonable requests to be involved with roles, goals, and responsibilities. And either they are resistant or they do not follow through. That's probably the thing that brings them in. And then underneath, the spouse of the passive-aggressive person will describe the emotional relationship with their with the passive-aggressive. How will they describe their emotional relationship? That it's generally what? Doesn't really exist. It's pretty empty. It's pretty Spartan, pretty barren. And so then you say, well, I can understand why. So why don't we get this guy to shape up? At least you, the therapist, have an ally. You know, now we can get this guy to shape up and be involved and engaged, and he'll be happy. He'll recognize and see what he's been missing out on all his life, and he'll be eternally grateful for you for enlightening him that all this emotional disconnect he's had has really been empty, barren, and Spartan. So he's going to be really glad. Those are probably the things. There's just very restricted involvement with the spouse, and they do that for a reason. If you're involved, to be involved, you have to have desires. Have desires means you have to have a want. You have to have some hope that it can be fulfilled. You have to have some hope that you can work it through, and it will come to some beneficial outcome. And the passive-aggressive person just, boom, they just fall down on every step along the way on that continuum. All right, so they show up in couples therapy. This is the stuff that makes you think, oh, when you hear that phone message, they're coming in. And they say they can only come in 1 hour next week. And you look at your calendar and you go, it's free. Bang. Now what do I do? So they show up. Now if you focus on the passive-aggressive person in couples therapy, they soon start complaining what? They complain that you, the therapist, what? You're doing what? Blaming and picking on them. All right, so that doesn't take too long before they say, how come you're making me the problem here? So you think, well, okay, I'll give them a break. I'll just talk with the other person over here for a while. Then after a while they complain what? That you are ignoring them. Oh, man, I'm picking on them, I'm ignoring them. Fun. I can't wait till next week when they come back. So, then they say you confront them on something because sooner or later you have to challenge them on what they're thinking or doing, how they're coming across either in the office or outside of the office in the marriage. You just have to start challenging what they're doing. And if they don't get testy, which they will do very, very quickly, the next fallback position they have is becoming what? Think about this. They get what? You start to confront them and work, because we value clarity. We value insight. So when you start offering them insight and you do it very, very gently and you think, boy, if they just get this, we're going to start getting some traction here and making some progress. So you give them a very well-crafted, well-paced, well-supported interpretation of what's going on, and they what? They respond with confusion. Go, it's so simple. If they just get it, just get it. And then you start to explain. And the more you explain, what happens? the more confused they get. And you know the old Uncle Remus tar baby fable? You just seem like you are getting stuck faster and faster. And you think they know that you're getting stuck? They do. Do they think you, do you know that they know that you're getting stuck? You know that they know. And they know that you know that they know. And you say to yourself, what do I do if they would just get it? We could get some traction here and make some progress. And whatever you do, it's just like that tar baby. You get stuck deeper and deeper. And then you say, well, if I just give up, now they've won. Now what? Next time I get it, all I got to do is get confused again. I back off. Then what? And you think, do I back off? Do I keep on going? And there's no good solution for you at this point. And you think, now I know why the spouse is angry all the time and why they give up in despair. Yes, I understand it. I get it. And then you tell them that this is what's going on between the two of you, and they don't get that either. And it's just confusing and frustrating, and you don't know what to do. And that happens over and over again. So you don't want to abandon it. Now, here's what would happen very quickly. I did this. I need someone just to come up here. Will you role play this real quick? It's about six transactions. So I'm sitting in the office, and you be Donna, okay? I'm sitting in the office, and I say to myself, I wonder if, this is a woman who is really passive-aggressive, and I say, I wonder if she thinks her husband has any legitimate, does she do anything that her husband complains about that's legitimate? Are there any legitimate complaints that she, that he has about her that she might recognize? So I say to her, well, Donna, do you believe that Steve has any legitimate complaints about what you do?
Well, I don't do 100% of what he wants me to do.
Did you hear that? Talk into this. So, Donna, do you believe Steve has any legitimate complaints about what it is that you do?
I don't do 100% of what he wants me to do.
Is that a great response? I don't do 100% of what he wants me to do. I'm hooked. I go to the next one and I say, well, do you believe that's a legitimate complaint of Steve's?
I don't know what you mean.
Like that. I'm in it and I know what's going on. And I say, so I'm going to try to clarify this. Okay? I'm going to try to clarify. And I know what's going on. This is how you get seduced into the dark side and you know what's going on. So I'm going to try to clarify it. And I say, well, Donna, earlier in the session, I asked Steve the same question. I said, Steve, what would be a legitimate complaint that Donna has about you? And I remember Steve said, well, she accuses me of not being responding very positive when she approaches me very affectionately. And that's accurate. She often approaches me, or sometimes approaches me, in a very positive way, affectionately, and I don't respond. And she accuses me of not responding very well. And that's a legitimate complaint that she has about me. So, Donna, that would be an example of a legitimate complaint. And Donna responds back,
well, what do you want me to say?
Just like that, you're into it. It goes that quick, that fast. Thank you. Thank you. And you know what's happening. I know. I look in the crystal ball, and I know as soon as she says, I don't do 100% of what he wants me to do, I know. We're not going to go anywhere, but I still try to clarify it. Later on, she said, well, as we were talking about it later on, because we do a lot of metacommunication, or I do a lot of metacommunication with couples I work with. Something happens, and then we'll stop and I talk about the process, about what took place. And she said, well, I thought you were trying to make me the problem. And so I take, what I do is, I interpret your interest or Steve's interest in me as a negative judgment. I interpret his involvement in what I'm doing as trying to control me. And so then he says, oh, wow. So when I get interested, when I try to get involved in what's going on in her life and show an interest, she just hears that as pain most of the time. She just hears it as pain. Now, the other thing that happens over and over again is the passive-aggressive will come across as a help-rejecting complainer, which means they will talk about a problem with the ostensible reason they want help. You identify a problem, and then they say to you something like this, well, what should I do about it? Now you know, if you give a response about what they should do, most of the time, your sage advice, carefully thought through suggestion, will be met with what? With what? Yes, but. Classic. Yes, but. And then you say, well, maybe I'll tweak it just a little bit. I'll say, well, what's the problem? And they say, here's the problem with your advice, or your suggestion. You adjust it, feed it back to them again, and what do you get? Same thing, another yes, but. Statistically, most of the time. So then you fall back on the tried and true tactic of almost every therapist when you're stuck. You say to the client, well, what do you think? And a good passive-aggressive has an answer. They don't go to school for this. The answers just seem to well up, but they're all the same. It's like they've all been in the same class, and they all have the same answer. And they'll say, well, aren't you the... I'm coming to you so that... You know, you tell me what to do. And now you go, well, yeah, I'm supposed to be the expert. I'm supposed to have some kind of resource and supposed to help them in some way. But you know that if you give them another bit of advice, you're just going to be back on the treadmill again. And now you're stuck. And then you think of the person who referred this couple to you again. And you think about what you would like to do as a referral for them or other fantasies. So the help-rejecting complainer is there. The other thing is this, is what you soon discover is that they resist being known very well, or they resist being understood. Now, this is kind of interesting because we tend to value insight, we tend to value clarity, clarity and self-understanding. A good passive-aggressive will come in and they will say, you know, I think I'm feeling depressed today. So, you know that you're not going to go wrong, and you just say back to them, oh, you're feeling depressed today. And they say, no, I think I'm tired. No, I really think I'm tired. I think I'm tired. They will avoid being known. They don't want to be known, because if they are known, they can be hurt. You have now got an inroad in there. So even when you do verbatim feedback, it gets denied at the next step. So they're not big risk takers, obviously, because to take a risk means that you want, if you have a want, you start to activate yourself, motivate to start moving in that direction to do something about it, but you don't, because you can be painfully disappointed. So all systems keep going to shut down restriction over and over again. Hypersensitive to criticism. One guy said about his wife, he says, and this was great, talk about having a fantasy. He says, I have the idea that my wife doesn't see my flaws. I have this idea that my flaws are not obvious. And so when she starts to criticize me, I think, I just have to put a stop to this criticism as fast as possible. So I will just shut it down. I will argue her out of her criticism so that she doesn't see my flaws. And if she's not too demanding, life is good. Life is good. But in a highly interdependent relationship, you cannot avoid making requests, being demanding, being judgmental, etc. You can't do it. And so the spouse is really stuck. Now, the next thing that they will do that really gets in the way often is they will nitpick with the word. You can give a carefully crafted explanation, definition, homework, or some, I don't care what you offer them. You think it's really good, ironclad, bulletproof. and they will nitpick with one aspect of what you're saying. And they will latch on to this 2%, and they will take something concretely or literally that wasn't meant to be that way, and they will focus on that. And they will nitpick it until you've lost the trail. You've lost the scent. And that's because you've been bogged down in the nitpick. And so, but it's what it's designed to do. It's designed to avoid being known and taking progress. And when you really, really get that, it starts to help you avoid the frustration. They are there to protect themselves. They are not there to change. They are there to protect themselves. That's their only goal, is self-protection, self-preservation. So you don't get so frustrated when they don't respond like other people might respond with insight, moving ahead. So how do they get this way anyway? Mostly it's learned, it seems. They will often describe in their family of origin some fairly common patterns. One very common pattern is a very overcritical, distant father. And you will often hear things like one guy said, I enjoyed playing baseball when I was a kid. My father sat behind the first base, you know, in the stands, and he kept criticizing and yelling at me so much. He said, I quit playing baseball. It wasn't worth it to have him at the games. Another guy said, my father took 7 newspapers and a bunch of magazines, and any time I wanted contact with him, I always had to push to get him to basically get out of his cave and do something. He said, after a while, screw it. It's not worth it. I am not signing up for repeated refusals and rejections. I won't do it. And it just goes all the way down the line, where another guy said, and this was more at this end of the continuum, he said, when I was a kid, my father had a really bad temper. He would grab me. Sometimes he'd just bang my head against the wall or slap me. My mother would come in the room, and she would yell at my father to quit doing that and then leave again. So he says, I was left with a father that I was afraid of and a mother that I couldn't respect or depend on. So the way I coped is I just shut down and said, I will learn how to endure. That's it. To show emotion is to be weak. I will just shut down and endure. And that's the way he goes through life, shut down and endure. And he is stuck. When he came in, he was hugely stuck. He hated his job, hated his work, but he didn't know what else he wanted to do. He had the idea he'd like to be a screenwriter, but he was afraid to take any movement in that direction. So then what does he do? Generally, in these family of origin systems, the mother is stronger and more powerful and a more dominant influence, contrary to that one example I just gave you. But she tends to be overprotective of the passive-aggressive person, overprotective in the sense of doesn't expect them to have reasonable participation in household responsibilities, chores, etc. So what happens is she gets overprotective, the father gets jealous, and that tends to amplify the criticalness and the distance. And so, as one guy put it very eloquently, he said, for my father, I could do no right, and for my mother, I could do no wrong. And that creates such an artificial, unreal world about how to go through for himself and the people around him. All right, what do you do with these people? Now they show up. You got an idea about what to look for, and what do you do with them? Referral is high on the list. That what? To someone you don't like. This couple just gets passed around. I would suggest that the first thing you do is you find something you can like about the passive-aggressive person. And it starts with you. Find something that you can appreciate, have some compassion about. You need to find this place within you when you start the harder work, when they break their agreements. when they get passive, when they go into confusion, you've got to have something within yourself that says, I can really respect or have compassion for this person because dot, dot, dot. Because it will affect how you talk with them. It's not so much what you say, but it's how you say it which will take priority. Because if you have the right voice tone and the right facial expression, you can say dang near anything to anybody. With the right voice tone and facial expression, it makes a huge difference, much more than what is being said. In a consultation group I had, there's a therapist in there, and she said she had this guy who was so passive aggressive in there, and she was talking about her countertransference. And I said, and we're talking about just what is it that really bugs you about this guy, other than, you know, he doesn't follow through and da da da. That's the first pass. That's obvious. That's logical. But what is it about that really seems to get you in a way that really just twists you in the stomach? And she finally said, well, you know what bugs the hell out of me about this guy is that he feels okay about being irresponsible. And I never, ever give myself permission to be irresponsible in any area of my life. I will take this commitment and make it as big as this commitment. I don't renegotiate. I will do until I am dropped dead with exhaustion before I will not do anything, not follow through, etc. And I hate it that he can do this and I can't. And she said, as we talked about it, she said, I really give myself such little leeway as I go through life. I am so demanding on myself and believe I should do dot, dot, dot. This guy has very few shoulds. It really, really bothers me. If you think about motivation, anytime your motivation, and this is the formula that I have in my head, which helps me understand motivation for anybody in the office, in terms of doing something. If you really want, what's the first question you want to ask somebody if to see if there's any high motivation? You want to ask what? How much do you, if they're motivated, what are you going to ask? Let me repeat this question. You want to know how motivated somebody is. So you say, how badly do you want it? How much do you want it? How bad do you want it? Now, if they say, I really, really want it, would you say they are motivated? If they say I want this job, I want this car, I want this pony, I want this whatever art, you know, for the house, I want this lazy boy that can recline, and the table right here I can put the beer and the chips. I really, really want that. That's my fantasy. So you say they really want it. Would you say then that they're motivated? Only if their behavior meets their words. But if they haven't really acted on it, they're just talking, what do you want in life? If they say they really want something, would you say then that they're motivated? There's two other elements to determine someone's motivation that you have to pay attention to. Say what? What they do. It's a little, there's even, what they do has to be broken down into a more refined way. So I say to somebody, you really, really want it? Okay. If you ask me what I really want, I would say, you know what I really want in my life? I want to be a place kicker for the San Francisco 49ers. Do I want it? Yeah. Do I want it a lot? Yeah. Now, likelihood of success. That's the second part of motivation. You have to look at likelihood of success. When it comes to place kicking, what I lack in talent, I make up for by having no experience. Which means likelihood of success is what? Zero. If you ask somebody, do you want to be wealthy? Well, yeah, I'd like to be rich. That's why I buy lottery tickets. You got to have more than just desire. Likelihood of success. What is the expected probability of success? So that's the second part of motivation. Do they really believe they will be successful in this endeavor? Now there's a third part, and it's what somebody said earlier about what are you going to do. But what are you going to do has to be broken down. So you have desire plus likelihood of success divided by the amount of unwanted necessary effort. Every stretch goal will have some part of effort that you don't want to do. You want to go into private practice? Fine. You got to deal with bookwork. You have to deal with billing. You have to deal with notes. You got to deal with HIPAA, .. whatever it is. All right? No, you work in an agency. Oops, more work, more paperwork. So there's always at least, some people might not mind paperwork in here. If you exist, I would like a transfusion. There is always in any stretch goal some amount of unnecessary effort that you don't want to do. And the more it is, the more you're just going to avoid going through. So a passive-aggressive person, number one, they have low desire. Expected probability of success in their life that they're going to get what they want is pretty negligible. Divided by the amount of unwanted effort, a lot. That's why you have somebody who's not very motivated as a passive-aggressive personality. But that formula applies in every other area of our life as well when we have a stretch goal. And if you're going to make a sustained change, that's just for motivation. Sustained change requires motivation that we just talked about. The equation has to be right, plus knowledge. You also have to have a certain amount of skill set, knowledge, and just data. And then you have to go out and collect experience so you can keep changing your insight and keep refining what kind of knowledge you need. So that's required for sustained change. Basically, people will only make a sustained change in their life for three reasons. And if you get these three reasons, it makes working with unmotivated people a little easier because you know what buttons to start pushing or not pushing on. But we only make sustained change for three basic reasons in our life. One is we want to avoid pain. So we will make a change to avoid pain. It just hurts too much doing what we're finally doing. You know, AA calls it hitting bottom. The pain now is so great that I will finally do something about it. All right. So we want to avoid a greater pain. That's a great catalyst for change. Secondly, we make a sustained change for the benefits involved. So you go to graduate school, you get a degree, you study for the orals or the written exams, which you're really not crazy about doing, but you do it anyway because of the benefits on the other side of getting licensed. So you do it for the benefits. We go through efforts for the benefits involved. And the third reason is just we want to be a better person. So those three reasons will cover most of why anybody makes any sustained change in their life. And if you know that, you really can start using it. And then we can do that when we start to make lighting the fire with a really hardcore passive-aggressive personality. Okay. So, when they come in, what do? You start to look at, you got to find something really, really that you value, appreciate, respect, or empathize with them. You start thinking about motivation. You start thinking about what is desire. You know, what's the amount of unnecessary effort anybody's going to have to take? Likelihood of success, now we're talking about risk. Is the risk worth the benefits? Then, right off the bat, and I do this in the first session, as soon as I can identify passive-aggressive personality, and generally, when a couple comes in, the first person to start talking will be the spouse. And they will start making complaints. And right off, you can start getting an idea that you're working with somebody who's passive-aggressive by how the marriage is being defined and described. And so I don't turn to the passive-aggressive person and say, what do you want out of being here? I will say to that person, what's your theory about why you're here? Because I just say, what's your theory about why you're here? And see what they say. But I don't start looking for a change right away. But in the very first session, what I'm going to start doing is start talking about, once I get clear that this person's a passive-aggressive, because I will ask for goals for themselves. And when they give me the don't want goals, the confused goals, the avoidance goals, etc., instead of getting frustrated and think, oh, geez, now what am I going to do? That becomes the foundation for right off the bat for setting the stage to begin getting a shift in the relationship. And I will start talking to that person. I'll say, you know what? It sounds to me like, and I'll say, you've done a really good job saying what you don't want. I'll use the neutral line here, positive, pull you forward so that under stress you don't go back here. I say, what do you imagine on this side that could be useful for you for coming in here in our meeting? And just to let you know, I'm not biased. I get paid the same whether you have positive goals or not. Does it make any difference? Whether you change or not, I still get paid the same. I'm not like a plumber, you know, who for the same fee has to keep coming back till it gets right. Rightfully or wrongfully, it's the way this process works. Can you think of anything? And I just say that as a way of motivating sometimes a person, that if they hold out against me, I don't lose. And I say, what is over here? And they will struggle. They will struggle a lot. And then I will comment. And I'll say, it seems to me that for one part of you, it's really, really hard to think about something that's positive, the benefits that will pull you forward, that will help make life more rewarding and enriching for you. Over here, it sounds like mostly what you want to do is avoid pain, get some relief, hope to be left alone. And if that happens, and I'll just say what I said earlier, if you get that and you are wildly successful, what you will have accomplished is spending most of your life feeling apathetic or indifferent with achieving negative goals. That's it. That's the best, that is the absolute best you can hope for by coming in here. And I think this, and then I'm going to make a speculation here. There are reasons, good reasons, why people do not set goals on this side of the line. And so what happens is this, is that people learn to avoid setting goals for themselves that feel good on this side of the line, that are rewarding, enriching, stimulating, and it makes life worthwhile spending your days on this planet. They avoid doing that as a way of protecting themselves. So often, people who have goals on this side of the line have spent so much of their life feeling painfully disappointed that they will avoid going over here to avoid pain in the future. So not having goals over here is a way of protecting yourself. Avoiding goals on this side of the line is actually a way that one part of you is attempting to emotionally take care of yourself to avoid re-stimulating, reawakening a lot of painful memories about what you didn't get in your life that was so precious to you at one time. Our challenge in here, should you decide to take it, is that at some point for you to begin taking risks about what you do want and take the risk that you're going to hit some pain in your life. Now, I can give you some tools and techniques and strategies that will reduce the pain, that will help not only reduce the pain, but begin to open up comfortably some possibilities for life on this side of the line. But I cannot do it if we're not working together. I can't do it without collaboration, cooperation, or permission from you. It won't happen. This is what I think. I also think this, and then I'll go on, I'll talk some about the wife, the bind that the spouse is in. I'm talking to a guy. But right off the bat, when I start getting clear and collect the evidence that this is what's going on, I feed it back to that person right in the very first session so that we can be collaborative. Otherwise, I will end up annoying that person trying to get information that just is antagonizing and frustrating to the passive-aggressive individual.
The Milton H. Erickson Foundation presents Challenging Couples, Challenging Therapists, held March 26th to 28th, 2004, in Los Angeles, California. If the recording does not conclude by the end of Side 1, then please turn your cassette over at that point to continue listening on Side 2.
I also think this, and then I'll go on, I'll talk some about the wife, the bind that the spouse is in. I'm talking to a guy. But right off the bat, when I start getting clear and collect the evidence that this is what's going on, I feed it back to that person right in the very first session so that we can be collaborative. Otherwise, I will end up annoying that person trying to get information that just is antagonizing and frustrating to the passive-aggressive individual. If you talk to them about being angry, the angry part of the passive aggressive, that generally leads to what? If you talk to them about you're just angry, where does that get you? Yeah, right. You know, you guys have been there. It gets you nowhere if you try to clarify and illuminate them about being angry. They don't go there because most of the time it's semi-conscious or unconscious anyway. And they would just think you're making them wrong yet again. You're blaming them for what's going on. And it just gets testy. It does no good to talk to them about being angry, the angry part of passive-aggressive. It does no good. Because you're not on the same page yet. You don't have permission to talk about that. You don't have the cooperation or the collaborative agreement yet to talk about that part of them at this point. A quick thing on nitpick is, what would be an example that you could say? What would be a nitpick example? If I said, let me see, what could I say to a passive-aggressive person that they would nitpick? Let's just say I gave this explanation that I just gave you. What would be a nitpick response from them? They might say what back? Can you think of a good nitpick response back? Oh, what do you mean by collaborate? Is that great? What do you mean by collaborate? That's brilliant. That is brilliant. And what do you mean by collaborate? Think about this. Because the next response would be that you would try to do what? Explain collaboration. All right. They explain collaboration. Brilliant. And then your next comment might be, and you might say collaboration is what? Working together. That's a good one. Collaboration is working together. And then you might say what? What do you want me to do? Do you see how fast it goes? Just like this. And you say, oh, man, now what do I do? So he says, well, what do you want me to do? You're brilliant. It's brilliant. God, I couldn't have scripted it better. What do you want me to do? And then you might say what? You know, you're starting to walk into the swamp and there's no exit. But you persist and you might say what? What do you want me to do? This is great. I want you to come to the sessions, do your homework, and participate while you're here. And then you say what? What would that involve? And man, you see how fast you could just get in deeper and deeper, and you're just walking through like this, and we try to use logic and explain and get them clarified, and it goes, oh man. So what might be a different response when say, what do you mean by collaborate? What might be a different response for that? This is great. This is really great. What might be a different response? Yes. This is good. Perhaps we're going to do an interpretation. Thank you. We're going to do a little interpretation here. Perhaps you're afraid that you might have to give up some control, or what was the other? Or you're afraid, maybe you're concerned they might try to get you to do something, and then you would say?
No.
Yeah. Why would you pick that? No, I'm not concerned about that. So now you're starting to think or feel what? And this is what goes on. I'm telling you, you guys have been there. You know what this is like in your office because you've been there. Any other response to what it means? What do you mean by collaborate? Yeah, another wonderful underneath bullseye interpretation, so you're right on. So you could say, well, you know, this is just a great example. You're trying to let the responsibility on me, is that right? So that it's not going to go anywhere, probably. So you give a bullseye, and this is a dead center interpretation, and then you say what? What do you mean? You guys are great. You've been there, and once you get that these are the kind of responses. Yeah, what else could you say to what do you mean by collaborate? Good. Let's turn it back. I like it. Well, what does collaboration mean for you? I don't know. You're the expert. You're the one who brought it up. What does collaboration mean? I don't know. Yeah, you brought it up. It's your idea. So that's good. All right.
Actually, I have some ideas, and I'm just wondering how I can succeed in remembering to do
it. Oh, that's good. Here's collaboration. Actually, I have some ideas for you. I'm just wondering if you will succeed at doing them. I'm not sure.
How could you remind yourself?
Oh, I like it. Now we're going to really... So, how could you remind yourself? Now, this is great. He hasn't even signed up yet for the agreement. And now we're going to clinch the nail, drive it home, and say, how could you remind yourself? And then you'd say, that's my job, or... I don't know. Yeah, that's okay. This is wonderful. This is great. So we're still working on getting out of the gate by being collaborative.
That's the point of which the other person will obviously see. This is what I have to
do. Oh, yeah. Thank you.
That's...
Exactly. Exactly. Thank you. The spouse says, see, I deal with this all the time. See? And you're thinking to yourself, yeah, I know. And if I was married, we'd be in therapy too. You know? And I hope that somebody else would do something with this person. If I were in your shoes, but you can't say that, can you? If that's what you're thinking. And we're still trying to get out of the gate with the word of collaboration, for crying out loud. Where are we going to go with the rest of the time when you think to yourself, we get bogged down on one word like collaboration? Where are we going to go with trying to create change? So, what else could we do? You guys are great for coming up with possible responses. And I'm believing every one of you will do something like what you're talking about today with this guy. So, what else could you say? He says, yes. Thank you. So you sit here listening to this, and a part of you can start feeling this rage, you know? Remember what I said earlier, try to find something you can like. You're still trying. Not easy. You got to find something you like so that when you do the confrontation, your jaw's not clenched. You know, and you try. You know how hard it is to be empathic with a clenched jaw? No, and you know you're supposed to be empathic and understanding. And you can feel it. You got one. You are so wonderfully tenacious. You have the quality of what? Tenacity. If it's something you're really going, you really are tenacious. Now, what do you feel with that response? You're wonderfully tenacious. That's good. A compliment. Okay, we don't know. We don't know what he's being wonderfully tenacious about. You know, at this point, you're stroking, theoretically, his tenacity about not getting what we're trying to. Theoretically, but you're thinking outside the box. You know, you're really thinking. You're thinking creatively. Yeah, we're working with cancer instead of pneumonia, so you don't want to apply pneumonia cures to cancer. You got to think differently.
Thank you.
So we're talking about how do we begin to reframe? How do we begin to think? How do we get to think differently? How about this? Talk about conditioned responses. We are totally conditioned if somebody asks us a question that we should answer. Right? We have to answer a question. They ask us and we're conditioned to answer because we're not politicians who just give you whatever answer they want regardless of the question. You just get whatever they want to say. So we want to be congruent. We want to give them a direct answer. Sometimes you're dumb as a rock, so you might say what? Right. You're creative in what you do. You think about it. Come up with something. In the meantime, so she says you're creative. You come up with some things. While you're thinking about what to come up with, I'm going to talk to your spouse. What does that do for you? It's too easy. It's too easy. It's too easy. So you could check out his process. Is there anything going on that would help make you lose track of where we are? Is something going on in here? Collaboration is a fairly well understood term. Is where I'm going creating some discomfort? You bet it is. You bet it is. Now, will he admit that where you're going is going to create discomfort? But you are right on, Amelia. Where you're going creates discomfort. And will he admit it? No. No. You guys are so good. I'm telling you, you guys are good and create to come up with all these possibilities. Last one, then I'll give you some, then I'm going to show you how to deal with broken agreements. Yeah. On one hand, you have a dilemma. You come here for help, questionable. It also seems like you're trying to defeat me, spot on. But it would be hard for him to admit that. It would be very hard for him to admit, you know, you're right. I'm paying big bucks so I can put another notch in my gun. Say, yeah, another therapist. Yeah, victory. Ah, I feel good. Yes. You're good. Yeah, you're, and stop. Now, if he says you're good and stop, what would that do? It has kind of an equivalent ring. Okay, one more and then we're going to go on. Yeah. He doesn't want to be known, right? Yeah. You are getting very close to knowing him. Right? Yes. Oh, think about this. I don't know what collaboration is. I don't know what you could sign up for. Are you willing to experiment or go on a little trip and see what that's like? For the moment. For the moment. See, yes. Think about what you did, and this is where I was gonna go to a concept, something very close to what you're talking about, which is number one, is admit, I would say back to him when you say, would you say, what is collaboration? The original question? What do I mean by collaboration? There's probably a dictionary definition of collaboration, which I don't know what it is. But even more importantly is, I don't even know what collaboration between you and me would be. I'm clueless what that would look like. I know this, or believe this, that if we start collaborating on something, and this is my value now, this is me, and this is exactly what I would say in the office. My value is this, that I think when we only have so much time on this planet, it's probably better finding things that we enjoy, appreciate, value, understand, and can do to spend some more time over here, not so much time over here. That's my value. I don't know what collaboration means for us. I guess we're going to have to work that out to see what it means. But at least theoretically or in the abstract, at some point it means you and I are going to have to talk about spending some time on this side of the line. That's all I know. And then you might say what? A nodding of the head. And he nods the head like this, and I say, hallelujah. Hallelujah. All I want is just a little bit of nudge. But I'm going to say, and it's true, I don't know what collaboration is going to look like between us. I will tell him what I value, which is a self-definition. I value this. At some point, we're going to have to go on this side of the line. I don't know how we're going to get there. I don't even know what the specifics would be. But at some point, collaboration involves we talk about what's on this side of the line in a way that we don't antagonize or frustrate each other. That's it. And he doesn't have to respond. So you ask if they both stand up, and you ask if they look at each other, and give each other a hug. It's very difficult to stand up and give a hug. They will adapt and comply. And it could be, yeah, the first time they've even touched each other. And that arouses all kinds of stuff. So absolutely, you can see what happens as a result of that experiment. The other thing I want to say is this. If I can avoid it, I never, ever ask couples to change. If I can avoid it, I don't use that word. I do not use the word change. What I will do is I will ask if they will experiment with improving or if they will experiment with adjusting something and do a short-term experiment. If I can avoid using the word change because it feels like we're going to get stuck or committed in a bad deal. If you use the word change. Well, do you want to change that? Well, right now I do, but next week maybe I think I don't want to make that change. So to the degree I can, I just say, are you willing to experiment with adjusting a response, improving a response in this situation as an experiment over the next week, over the next 2 weeks, or do it once or twice just to get, do it at least twice to get some feedback for yourself about whether or not it's even a viable thing. So, I avoid the use of the word change. Now, just going back again to this wonderful thing about, he asked what I mean by collaboration. My own personal way of working with, and there's a lot of theoretical probably disagreement, but in working with these couples, and really high distress couples, high dysfunctional couples, I will talk about what I tend to value and why. So that they know. Too often they grew up in systems and families where things were imposed on them without any understanding of why. So if I'm going to have an influence, I would like them to know where I'm coming from and why that's important. And that tends to make it more collaborative. If I just try to, quote, get him to do something without saying where I'm coming from or why, I tend to get that kind of resistance that I've helped create. And then I can blame him, but really I've been part of it unwittingly myself, my way of thinking in this system. But here's what's going to happen. You're going to, sooner or later, you will have, it happens with every couple you see, but it happens more with the notion of broken agreements. You will do a carefully crafted agreement in your office. For 1 week, and you'll say, we're only experimenting, we're just trying to see what happens, We're going to do an experiment for a week, and then we'll talk about it. And it's really clear what happens. Here's an example. Then we're going to role play. I got a volunteer to role play how you deal with this broken agreement process. I said to, and this would be the headline, John, of the situation, because they have so few desires in their life, I said to this guy, I said, here's what I want you to do between now and when we meet next week. If you're willing to really push and stretch yourself, and it's not going to be comfortable, but here's, if you're willing to try it, here's my suggestion. I would like you to brainstorm a list of things that you think have the possibility, I'm not talking practical now, but just the possibility of that would inspire you to feel good. Things that you would do by yourself, things that you would do with your spouse, things you would do with friends, things that you would do inside, things that you would do outside, things that you would do with in different seasons of the year, things that would require exertion, things that require intellectual effort. I'm trying to give as many categories of responses as I can for him to brainstorm in these different categories. And I tell him, I say it, and this is why I'm suggesting it, back again to the restricted life, my value. It's good to have a few more things on this side of the line than try to exist over here. He said, all right, sounds good. I'll be willing to do it. And he said, and I would like to have my wife help me too. So I will make up a list, and then I'd like to sit down next Saturday morning with my wife and to continue brainstorming this list. And I think that would be really good. Next week, he comes in, they come in, didn't happen. Why? Friday night, he said he would be home at a certain time. He would work late and then not call. Happened again. He worked late, didn't call Friday night. He gets home late. They have a big fight. Now they can't do their exercise Saturday morning. They come in. They haven't done it. And that's where we would pick it up. And so John is going to role play this guy. Before he comes in to role play, he comes in, he doesn't get it done. Is the spouse angry that he didn't do the homework? Disappointed? Yet again. But this is what I've been telling you, dear therapist. You can't count on him. He says he will do it, and he doesn't do it. She's disappointed and or despairing and or frustrated, depending on how many times it's happened or how long. She could just be going back into despair. You got her hopes up. Now it's not working. She's now, you got a problem with her in terms of her despair and frustration. What do you do? How do you think about what to do when they come in? Homework wasn't done. They both agreed to do it. Not done. How do you think about it? What do you do? Not easy. And it happens again and again and again with these couples. What can we learn from this? All right, that's a good one. What can we learn from this? What else? We got a room full of therapists. A very common experience. We're going, God, what would we do with this? Jeez, I know what I want to do, but I don't want to admit it in front of everybody. Get them to say what they would do, meaning what? We've already established they're going to do the homework and they haven't done it. So they've already made the agreement. It wasn't done. Now they're back in your office. Do what? Oh, okay. So do it in class. Yeah. Okay, so you do it in class. So you do it in the session. And then they go, well, okay, so that's a possibility. You find it. Well, there wasn't any objection. We had a fight Friday night. If we hadn't had the fight, we would have done it. Because I was really looking forward to doing it. But we had this fight. Oh, give him a stroke. I'm impressed you guys showed up. Even though you didn't do it, you didn't play hooky. You know, that's good.
clarify my motivations, my values. This is as far as I can go. It's a decision they made, yeah. Oh, think about this. There is a part of him that made the agreement and was fired up, at least when we did it. And then there was another part of him that overrode, and maybe they could talk to each other. That's exactly what I was going to demonstrate. Right. Yeah, not have any judgments. If I kind of redo the critical father role, not have any judgments I'm accepting, and that could help maybe do some kind of corrective emotional experience. Here's what I will do, though, to help both people, because what I'm going to do with John is what I will also do with the spouse later on with her dilemma. So, John, come out here. If you would take this. And so I might say, so last week when we made the agreement that you would do this exercise, it seemed last week that there was a part of you that seemed to be fairly genuinely interested in doing this. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah, there was a part of So there is a part of you that was really interested in doing this, and then something happened, and the part of you that really wanted to do it was overridden by another part of you that said, no, circumstances show up, don't do it, too difficult, or something. So you have a conflict between one part of you wants to follow through. Is that right?
No.
There's not a conflict between one part of you wanting to follow through?
I wanted to follow through, My wife was so unreasonable. I mean, this is just the way it always happens. Anytime I try to make a positive change, she finds a way to blame me about something, whether it's something from the past, something from the present, just some little thing, whatever it is. There was no way we were going to talk to each other on Saturday morning.
Right.
See, I can't win.
Well, you know what, John? You can't win in two ways. You can't win the way you just described it with your wife. That's one way that you can't win. You can't win in another way. And it's the other way that you can't win that I want to focus on right now. And the way that you can't win within yourself is one part of you wanted to do it for a lot of good reasons. Because, frankly, spending all this time on this side of the line is like going through life with anvils on your legs. And, yeah, you can get through life okay, but you will not really hit your natural stride. And when we were talking last week about the benefits of doing this, we knew that it wouldn't be easy. We knew that something would come up for whatever reason that we couldn't anticipate that would make coming over to this side of the line hard. So it's not only that you struggle with your wife, you struggle with yourself in the sense you let one part of yourself down that really wanted to do this for its own reasons.
Why can't you see that it was her criticism that derailed me?
That was part of it. That was part of it. And if we can, and we're going to come back to that part of it about the criticism. And right now, I want to, if we can just stay a little bit longer on your own conflict within yourself, the split. I wanted to do it. I didn't get it done. Can we do that for a minute?
But she agreed to help me, and then she wasn't there for me.
And you're not there for yourself in a key ways. Remember all the ways we've talked about when sometimes you have set goals for yourself, and then they don't get followed through with.
I mean to do them. I'm just not getting the support I need.
All right. So one has to do with support from her. One has to do with how you support yourself. When the going gets tough, and if we can do one exercise, and if we can get clear ahead of time, maybe we can get some further clarity for the part of you that wants to spend more time on this side of the line. Is that okay?
Why am I always the one that has to change? Why can't she change? Why can't she just stop being so nagging, negative?
She will, but it's going to take both of you to work on it, and I can't get her off your back. I need to work with both of you. Right now, it's not the one I'm talking to. Later on today in the session, I'm going to talk to your wife. So you're right. She will also have... I need to talk to her about her situation, too. Right now,
but she just said you can't get her off my back. So what good is talking to her going to do? I mean, it makes me wonder why we're even here.
Let's take it from the top again, John. There's a part of you. You remember last week when you said you would call her if you're going to be late?
I didn't mean to spend so long at the bookstore. I worked late, and then I was thinking about some of the problems, and I thought, well, I'll go to the bookstore. Maybe I'll find a book on this. And, I thought, well, maybe I'll find one for her. I know her favorite author. So, I lost track of time. And I was trying to be thoughtful. I bought her a book by her favorite author. I mean, is it my fault it's one that she already read? I pay attention. I know who her favorite author is. She could at least have thanked me for that. I mean, I was being thoughtful. And you don't even seem like you care. I mean, are you on her side too?
We have a problem. And we're at a crossroads, and I would just like for you to listen, because we may not end up working anymore. This could be our last session. It's that important to me. So I don't know if we're going to keep working together or not. So what I'm saying is this, it's that crucial, John. Here it is. All I can do is help you increase your own awareness about how you've been stumbling through life so you can find a different way to get there. Right now, it's got nothing to do with your wife. It's got everything to do about you and me in this moment. If we can't get into any agreement at all about working together, then you're wasting your money. All you're doing is just feeding my PO. You just fund my PO, period. So here it is. We're at a crossroads where I say to you, John, it's a problem of integrity. And that's different than with your wife, struggling with your wife. It's a problem with integrity with yourself, where if you make an agreement to do something, whether or not you follow through, when it's really difficult. And if you want to give me a lot of reasons why it's too hard to follow through, that's okay with me. But I'm not going to fight you for it every inch along the way. If you say to yourself, you want to be a more effective partner, you want to be more trustworthy, more reliable, I can help you do that. If that's a priority and or important for you.
I've been trying for years. She just doesn't understand how, what I go through trying to succeed at this stuff. She's very critical, but yeah, I want to change.
Why? Why do you want to change? Why do you want to improve your reaction? Why do you want to live with more integrity with yourself so that when you say you're going to do something, you believe that you will follow through regardless if it's difficult or not? Why do you want to do that?
Because I'm over 50? It's time?
That's one reason. Is there another reason besides being over 50?
I want to be happier. You keep calling it integrity. I mean, I just think things get in the way. Life happens.
Listen to me. I do call it integrity. which means if your wife can't trust you to follow through, that's one thing. Which means that basically you guys don't create many goals in your life together, because trust is the very foundation of achieving all the goals that you can create. You can't count on somebody to follow through. Why even plan? That's at one level. That's not the level I'm talking about. I'm talking about your own integrity as you go through life, whether or not you set a goal for yourself, if you believe you're going to follow through with it when it's difficult. That's the level I'm talking about right now. And I am not going to try to drag you across the finish line to say that that's a good thing to do.
I'm supposed to do it myself.
I'll work with you.
That would help.
Thank you. As we talk about this, John, what do you feel?
A little nervous. A little like I'm in the principal's office again.
With one difference, John. I'm not here to punish you, and you can walk out anytime you want.
Well, I know the session's going to be over pretty soon, but I'd like to get something out of it.
Here's what I would suggest. There is a part of you that's very skeptical.
Based on real experience, yeah.
Well, let me rephrase that, John. How would you identify that conflict that you have within yourself? Or let me put it this way. What did you hear me say to you? I'll put it that way. What did you hear me say to you, John?
You told us that we should go home and make lists of things that we could enjoy doing together. And I really wanted to do that, but when I woke up Saturday morning after having this fight with her Friday night, I looked at the expression on her face and I just lost all hope. I mean, she was still mad.
Let me put it this way, then we're going to come back to you with what's going on with us right now. A person really wants something. If they're highly motivated, they'll find a way. If they're not motivated, they'll find excuses. It's as simple and as difficult as that.
So I need to find a way to succeed, even though she's criticizing me every step of the way.
Thank you, John. That is exactly what I'm talking about.
If I succeed more, you think maybe she'll criticize less?
I have no idea. I have no idea.
I always thought maybe if she criticized less, I'd succeed more.
I have no idea if that's true.
Would you be willing to help her some?
No. Because right now it's not about her. It's about what's going on with you right now as we talk.
I'll make the list.
It's not about making the list right now. It's about this. Does it seem to you that you have a conflict within yourself that's got nothing to do with your wife?
Well, yeah. I mean, there have been lots of things I've wanted to do in my life where, I get these great ideas and then something comes up and I just don't follow through on them.
That's exactly right. You get great ideas and you don't follow through. And that's not about your wife. It's about you. So one part of you has the dream. One part of you has a vision. And one part of you, at least for a small period of time, can get excited about getting there. And then another part of you shows up and does what?
Well, it's not that the other part doesn't want to. I mean, I guess sometimes the part is a little skeptical and feels like, gosh, I don't know if I'm able to do that. It might take a lot of time and effort. Maybe I was being grandiose and thinking that this would work. I mean, it's just a whole lot of real-life possible problems with the dream make it seem less realistic.
What you are experiencing is what every human being on this planet experiences when we set a stretch goal for ourselves, a goal that is really out here. It's like, here we are. Here's a stretch goal. And think of a big rubber band that goes around my two thumbs. The farther the stretch goal, the more tension there is. And something will have to give. Either this part right here that's very scared, that feels inadequate, doesn't deserve, doesn't have the skills, the talent, the knowledge, If this voice is too loud, too strong, it will start pulling this goal in. I'm not smart enough. I don't have enough money. I don't have enough talent. I don't have the skills. And we'll keep pulling this in like this.
That looks familiar.
If this goal is compelling enough, if this goal is consistent with our values, our interests, our natural talents, and it feels like it's significant for us, with this, it starts to pull over here toward the goal like this. Most of the time you've been living, when the rubber band gets stretched, the dream keeps coming back to here. I can help you change that.
Great.
Now, we did not do the demonstration that I thought we were going to do. And it's like therapy. It's why you can't really have confidence in a treatment plan, because all therapy is action-reaction. And it changes by the moment. I thought I was going to do two-chair work with John.
If we still have time, I can do that if you want.
It's okay. And I know you could. And I know, and what I would do is I would talk to him about a dream, a specific dream he has, versus the anxiety, the fear over here. And I would say, tell me about a dream you have over here. And you might say, a dream might be what? Having my own dance company over here. Say, great. And in this part of you over here, talk about why. Not what, talk about why that's so inspiring to you. And he would start listing the reasons why that is meaningful, significant, and inspiring. Then I would say, now come over here and be the other part of you. And be the part of you that is scared, skeptical, resistant, anxiety. And speak from this part. Great. And then I would say, now come over here and respond. And I would get the dialogue, just like you said in the back, going back and forth between these two parts. Gets me out of the middle of doing that. They may or may not, and I would say from each side, from the scared part over here, do you see what he brings to the table that is of value, that is worthwhile? Yeah, yeah, yeah. Can you see what he brings to the table that's worth listening to, that's valuable? I do not believe in my own mind, nor do I want this person up here, John in this case, to see this person as being a saboteur, as being sabotaging, because I don't believe it. Person over here is doing everything he can over here to protect that part from getting out there too far and getting hurt and disappointed. I want these two parts to start collaborating and negotiating with each other. That's how you get out of the middle of these broken agreements, because this is what you're working with, is the fear and the dream. And how do you get those two parts connecting? Now, that's why I would take it if we were going to have more time in a session, but just in terms of your reflections and or reactions as I was talking to John up here, because we were going in a path that Frank didn't think we were going to go originally, but just your reflections or reactions in terms of how I was dealing with him. Well, I knew what I was up against. Yeah, I knew exactly what I was up against, you know, which is what you're going to be up against, what I'm up against all the time in the office. Offload on the spouse, it's not my fault, dot, dot, dot. Only, the only difference is most of us in our office don't do it in front of a whole audience of our peers. That's the red face. So I just kept going back and back to him and not get derailed. Calmness with the ferocious, I like that. Calmness with the ferocious intensity. Absolutely, there was an intensity. I like ferocious intent, that's kind of an interesting. Would I do this in front of his wife? You bet your sweet acidophilus I would do that in front of his wife. I'm threatening to kick him out of treatment. You would never do that. Listen, clients fire us all the time, don't they? They just don't come back. And we're not supposed to be rejected. We're supposed to be more like the Statue of Liberty. Give me your tired, your hopeless, your teeming masses, your decrepit, wretched refuse of the world, and I will help them whether they want it or not. We're not supposed to fire clients. That's abandoning them, but it's not abandoned if you give a referral and say why. And when I did that, the first time I did that, with a really bitter, angry, resentful person in a couple, nothing I could do could alter. And she was in a lawsuit. She was in a car wreck, and she was in a lawsuit, and they were going to pay, you know. And she was bitter and angry, and that was even before the lawsuit. They were bitter and angry. And after four sessions, I said, I think I'm not the best resource for you guys. But with what you're struggling with, I don't think I'm the best resource. I do not make them wrong. Because somewhere there's probably somebody that will do a better job than me in any given situation. I don't make them wrong. I am not the best resource. I feel okay. I did not want to get into supervision and spend to try to overcome my countertransference. I would resent that even more. You know, and then it's really a knot. And then I didn't want to have to spend time trying to get over that, although that's what I should do. I didn't want to do it, and it felt very liberating when I said, I'm not the best resource for you guys. And I really believe that. And here's what I think. So, yeah, I give myself permission to say, we may have gone as far as I could go. And I'm okay, because I am not going to spend week after week with someone like that trying to convince him to do something different. We're going to have a come to Jesus discussion. And we either are going to make something different happen, or we're not. And I'm totally fine either way. And it took me a long time to get there. It took me a long time to get there. Here's what I think as a therapist is useful. Here's how you get there. I can't get you there. And furthermore, I'm not going to fix your wife. He says, are you going to get her to change? How do you phrase that? What did you say?
I asked you if you were going to help her change. My goal became during the dialogue to try to give you as much resistance as some of our most difficult clients might.
Let's
to
just
see
say,
what
John,
you could model.
Good. You are good, John. You met your goal. Thank you.
I was trying to give you the challenge so that you could demonstrate some way to overcome my resistance, which you did. And one of the things that I found particularly helpful was when you said, I'm not going to drag you across the finish line. And, you know, it seemed like you were being very straight with me and very focused and very dedicated to me. A little scolding, but it worked. I wanted to give you the opportunity to show people what would work with somebody who was really resistant, and you did it beautifully.
Thank you. Thank you. Right, right. I'm a geeky bro. I'm not getting it. I'm a therapist. Get it, Pete. It's the wife.
Side and run against me.
Oh, that's that nitpick. You know, when people nitpick, you agree with what they're saying and do not get derailed. So he said, yeah, wife's a problem, sure. Right now, that's not the real issue. So you acknowledge and go back. Yeah, oh man. Yeah, I just kept bringing it back. I mean, and I have a lot of empathy for her. Here's what I would do with her. One is that I say, you know, you're in a dilemma. I say to the wife, you're in a dilemma. You want something positive to happen in this relationship. There's a part of you that really wants something positive to happen in a marriage. You want to build, construct, ... And that part of you is really frustrated. And the more you want to have that happen, I can understand why you say you're finally left with two horrible responses. Either A, you keep nagging, cajoling, pushing, trying to do something to get him to be more responsive because you want to create a bigger picture for what you can build together. You're stuck between nagging or giving up and saying nothing, and then you just go into despair. And then what does he think? Well, I guess things are better. She's off my back. You're screwed, I say to the wife. You cannot win in this kind of situation. So that's a way of it, like acknowledging one part this, another part that. Whatever response you feel, one part of you is going to feel like it's not working. I will do two-chair work, or connecting the divided self, which is what I call when a person has a split. It's connecting the divided self. I will work with her on a dialogue between speak up, don't speak up. What are my choices? I want to stay together. I don't want to stay together. I'm getting fed up. I will have this dialogue in front of him. And then I do the third thing, which is I will say to the person, I want you to come over here and be my consultant. So I would say to John, come over here and be my consultant. I'll try to get some kind of agreement. What step could you take this coming week that would be worthwhile that both of you could agree on? If nothing happens, I say, come over here, be my consultant. What do you notice as my consultant, John, about these two parts right here? Well, this part really does this, that part really does that. And I'd say, good observation. What would you suggest for each part to take a step, not to solve the problem, but just a step to experiment with making it better? And that, and 90% of the time, I will get a bullseye response from the person about how to start breaking the logjam. If I had to give up doing this process of connecting the divided self, if I had to give that up as therapy, I'd quit working with couples or maybe even a lot of individuals, because I want to get out of the middle of their civil war. I have to get out of the middle, having them talk to each side of themselves. If you don't have training in that, get training. There's also, Ellen and I just came out with a new album about 3 or 4 weeks ago, which is High Impact Couples Therapy. In this album, we go through and explain how to do this kind of connecting the divided self process with an individual in front of their partner. We also go through a lot about goal setting, so that you can get how to deal with these we goals. We need to respect each other. We need to be a better communicators. We need to negotiate better. We need to get on the same page. If you've got to confront those we goals, we talked about how to do that in here, which gets you out of the middle. And even more importantly, if you've got a tough couple, how do you make the shift happen before they even come in? And when somebody talks about, here's this, because I always say, give me a headline of what your situation is. And if they say, we're really fighting a lot, we haven't had any decent conversations in the last 5 years, I will say, okay, I give them a homework assignment. I say, when you guys come in, each of you are going to have things that you want the other person to change. I get that. I also want each of you to think about this. What can you do to be a more effective partner so that when you come in, I'm really curious how you see what you can do to be a more effective partner? That's what I want you to think about before you come in. Otherwise, what they think about before they come in is building the case about why their partner should do all the changing first. So that's not what I want them to be rehearsing before they come in. All right, I just want to say two things. One is, I appreciate a lot the action, the activity, the participation, because today in this session, you've got to have that kind of activity when you're working with a passive-aggressive couple or a lot of high-distress couples to begin with. You have to be active. And then you can taper off the activity. But and I really appreciate your participation. You're willing to share. And, John, thank you for coming up and giving me a challenge. I want to thank you again, John. Thank you. And I want to leave you with a metaphor, a visual metaphor. And a couple first comes together. And when they come together, everything is good and it's whole and it's really bright. And their future looks really bright when they first get together. And then over time, it seems like, oh my God, some of those bright things just seem to be kind of like disappearing and going away. And they just get smaller and smaller. And they have struggles and they fight over it and they wonder what's going to happen. And then pretty soon they go, oh, it's gone. And they go, oh, man. Well, at this point, what they do is they come in to see you. And then so they call you up and you say, oh, yeah, what are you going to do to be a more effective partner? You remember, it's not personal. You remember, keep the focus on the partners here. You learn how to help them connect with the divided self. And you understand now what the rules are, how to deal with the nitpicks and the resistances. And then after a while, when you work with them, all those great, bright things come back again. And they are so grateful that you have worked with them. Thank you.